Hello, my name is Jen Hickey. Welcome to the WEN podcast, a series of conversations with people as they share their WEN moments. Recognizing these times can change our destiny, help us to stop hiding behind the past or clinging to a future that may or may not happen. This podcast is about recognizing the power of the WEN moments. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the WEN podcast. So this week, to end series two, I'm delighted to be joined by Stuart Wilson of Zest Life. We had such a huge response from our last podcast together, so we decided to sit down again. And we have broken this podcast into two, as we could have literally sat there and talked for hours. So we are discussing disordered eating and anxiety and peer pressure in children and teenagers. So I wanted to say two thank yous. Firstly, one for Stuart for again giving me his time and his experience on these topics. Please visit his website for more information. And I'd also like to thank all of you for all of your kind messages of support and feedback since launching the podcast. I've really enjoyed every bit of it, and hopefully we'll be back soon with series three. So let's get going. Thanks very much. So I'm delighted that we are welcoming back Stuart Wilson to the podcast. So welcome, Stuart, again. We had such a great response from your last podcast. So we've decided to get together again and discuss a few really important topics. So thank you so much for taking the time. Good to see you.
Total pleasure. Great to be back. Great to have a chat with you again. I think it just is a sure sign that we're all struggling as parents. Is that right?
Oh God, yeah. Have you got about 4 hours to get through all this? So we're going to kick it off with eating disorders. Now, I already covered very small. Obviously, this is a topic that you could talk about for hours. So we spoke to a dietitian earlier on in the series. So it's actually great that we can talk to you now because you're coming from it from the kind of psychology side of it. So just to kick off, can we just start by what you term as an eating disorder?
Okay, so I think it's really important to differentiate between disordered eating and eating disorders in general terms, because I think parents are struggling a lot at the moment to know what's the difference, what does one look like compared to the other, you know? So in some ways, probably let's talk a little bit about the disordered eating side of things, first of all, Jen, if that's okay.
Because yeah, absolutely.
I think this is probably more common and something we're seeing a lot of in quite a few houses currently. And I suppose disordered eating is the term that's used more for irregularity, let's call it, between around eating behaviors. And that doesn't necessarily warrant a diagnosis of a specific eating disorder, but it can be connected to emotional eating, you know, for either from emotional eating in the context of comfort food, eating to fill a void, or kind of getting into the kind of yo-yo dieting kind of side of things. And what we do see quite a lot of these days is that that is a lot more prevalent in boys than it would have been before. And so whereas we would have typically, from an old-fashioned context, probably saw disordered eating more from the context of girls, we're seeing probably one in four cases now is our young boys. And I think that lends itself into the whole area of disordered eating, the whole area of body image and what boys perceive they want to look like or should look like, and that pressure on them. And also girls then, from the context again of body image, getting into their teenage years. Usually girls, it's a little bit older than boys. You start to see this become prevalent in boys, sometimes young as 11 or 12, Jen. But girls probably just a little bit older, probably getting into the kind of second year in school, probably that sort of 14, 15 kind of age group especially, you know. So that's kind of more the disordered eating side of things. And we also need to be very careful, because when we're talking about eating disorders is a much, so disordered eating can lead towards eating disorders. And from a psychological context, we can generally assist young people with disordered eating to understand why they eat, as opposed to what they eat, but why they eat, and assist them to understand it may be connected to their lying self-esteem or anxiety or other things like that. And that lends itself more in towards significant eating disorders, and we can talk about the signs and symptoms of that if you wish, but that parents are getting more concerned that this isn't just, you know, conversations and communications about what they could eat, should eat, or might not eat, or emotionally going to the fridge if they're feeling a little bit stressed, or you know, common things that we would see, which might be slightly disordered in its style, eating disorders lead into a significant medical condition, Jen, which is incredibly serious and very important to nip early or to get medical advice on early. And even from a psychological context, Jen, would need a team effort, you know, so that psychotherapeutics might be a part of that. But as you said, dietitian, nutrition, GP, psychiatrist is all a part of a multidisciplinary team that would work with somebody who understand an eating disorder to assist parents and to be able to work with the young person themselves to know what to do about it.
Yeah, it's a really scary topic, actually, I think. And even the way you described the two there, because do you think that, and I know what you're saying about the boys as well, because I have two boys myself, and they are very, love working out and looking good and clothes and all this. So it's not just my daughter that loves that now. Is this something, do you think, that's on the increase because of things like social media?
Very definitely. I suppose it's great that we're having this conversation. To be honest, I think we push this conversation underground a lot. So I'm really glad that we're talking about this.
Okay.
And I think parents will be glad that we are talking about this. Very often with eating disorders, one of the biggest difficulties we have with not just disordered eating, but an actual eating disorder, is that we wait too long for a diagnosis. So we do need to bring this conversation into our homes and to communicate about these things. And actually, quite often I hear from clients coming into our own offices that, you know, teenage girls' friends are very aware that their best pal or their one within their group or with boys knows about their long-term disordered eating even more than the parents know about it sometimes, because they're seeing it from a school perspective or when they're together. If you think about it, we spend so much time in school at break times, lunch times, that they would see that. So I think the conversation has been pushed underground, and it's great that we're talking about it now. But yeah, we do see a lot of it being across both sexes. The boys' side of it is very interesting in recent years because of social media. So it's a lot more about what boys want to look like as opposed to even sometimes the healthy look or the healthy or wellness look. I'm all for eating well, all for the pillars of, you know, the three pillars I always talk to you about: sleep, nutrition, and obviously exercise. But if it's over the top, in other words, I have to be chiseled, I have to look a certain way, or anything else is not acceptable, is that actually lending itself into disordered eating? And truthfully, quite often with that type of body image concerns for teenage boys, we do find it does lead into, you know, if you find yourself weighing your food and being that specific, sometimes we're leading into anxiety, you know?
Yeah. And I suppose, like, because it's so difficult, really, isn't it? Because as a parent, you're trying to feed them well and you're wanting this healthy balance, I suppose. The balance is the word that you're looking for. But when, so what are the signs of, let's go, disordered eating, first of all? So when you think that when something is possibly not right, because we want our kids to be healthy, but like you say,
yeah,
when do you cross the line there? When should you be kind of sitting up as a parent going, oh, something's not right here?
I think whether disordered or whether eating disorder, I think we need to have the conversations and not be afraid of them. It's a little bit like talking, if we're terrified of having the word suicide be mentioned in our homes, where we say, you know, we just never talked about it. Let's talk about it. Kids will generally respond not to, you know, respond a little bit negatively if we say, I'm worried about what you're eating. If a child is already anxious and we say, I'm worried about what you're eating, you know, what's the story there? The general chances are we're going to push them into more negativity and more upset about it. So we probably need to keep an eye on things and make our homes and food eating times a very, very, I suppose, less stressed place. But the signs are obviously things, frequent dieting, you know, where we see kids having chronic weight fluctuations, whether up or down. I suppose specific kind of rituals and routines around food. You might see kids starting to hide or not eat with the family, or say when they come home from school, I ate earlier, or I went to my friend Megan's house and I ate there instead of coming home and having dinner with the family. Or early signs, and again, it's age appropriate. So that could even be 12, 13, 14 years, Jen, where it's conceivable that they have eaten somewhere else. But if you see it over extended periods of time And that usually disordered eating, you'll see things like they're talk not just about food, but you'll also hear things about their body image or how they look or, you know, what they're wearing and things like that. And you see that impact on sometimes their kind of quality of life, you know.
And what about exercise? What about exercise?
And that's where the exercise, I guess, leads into disordered eating and exercise coming together, or over-exercising can certainly lead us down the road of worrying about an eating disorder then, because obviously if we're watching our food or not eating what we should or things like that, and there's food restriction, I can quickly move into then food restriction and over-exercising, and the biology of your body starts to change. And that's where probably we lead into the next part of the conversation, which is, what do we watch out for if it's an eating disorder? Because if it starts to go down a road where it seems like the eating has been disorderly previously, what are the sort of signs and symptoms we should be kind of watching out for after that? And I guess, you know, in general, some of the things we've just mentioned there, literally sometimes the biology of your body can start to change. So for girls, they might start skipping a menstrual cycle, or it might be that you're starting to see a difference in their weight, that there's an over preoccupation on keeping covered where they don't want you to see how they look, or it could be just hiding away at changing times. You know, all the things that we think are very obvious, but that we just don't necessarily notice. Constant mood swings and frequently checking themselves in front of mirrors and all sorts of stuff like that, or even just skipping meals. They're the emotional and behavioral things. The physical things that you will start seeing is a lot of things around irregularities, like their tummy cramps, potentially even dizziness, kind of fainting, sleep problems is a common thing.
Crikey.
Go along with that. Or they can start having, if it gets into a dangerous places, you can start seeing issues around their skin. You can notice differences in their hair. It becomes a biological condition quite quickly if it's gone from disordered eating, over-exercising, into an acting disorder. And of course, watching out for the signs of potentially, if it was going down towards bulimia or such like, that you could start seeing evidence of binge eating, and then obviously into areas where they could be purging, you know?
Yeah. And no child, I'm assuming, sets out to develop disordered eating or an eating disorder. So, you know, could this be stemming? Well, it obviously is stemming from something emotional, like a trauma, for example.
Yeah. And I think that's where early signs, for instance, if we see just some disordered eating or emotional type eating, positive, like holding back or pushing forward from food for different reasons, I think that's when it's good to connect in therapeutically with somebody. And it doesn't mean it's an eating disorder. It could mean it's an underlying anxiety related issue or body image issue with the correct therapy assistance that can then be kind of, you know, corrected, and people can gain esteem from that and feel more confident in themselves. That doesn't lead to anywhere. It brings back on track, if you like. Where it develops into, if you've got a concern as a parent at all in an area of an eating disorder and you link in with somebody therapeutically, even if their area is not specialized eating disorders, they will very quickly connect you back to a GP. But I would say to parents, if you're concerned at all in relation to an eating disorder, go directly to your GP and have this conversation with them. And, you know, from there, they can guide you the best route to be able to get assistance, of which therapy could be certainly a part of that. But you do need specific training, like we said earlier on at the beginning of this, to work with young people, particularly when it is an eating disorder. There's very specialized training in that, which is a part of the team, Jen, which I mentioned earlier, with psychiatry, with a GP, and can even be, if it's done very well, connecting in with school for that young person for the future. Could be even with guidance counselors and helping parents to understand what they can do that will help, so that they're not in that. Because it's terrifying as a parent if you're worried about your child who may have an eating disorder. You feel helpless, and what can I do? Because it's feels like it's so much out of your control.
And is it something that you should start to talk with your child straight away, or should you go straight to a GP without the child initially, if you're concerned?
I think it's a, I think it's, we tread on eggshells about this, Jen, and I'm a great believer in, you know, if there's signs before we have that conversation, and we can usually see the signs, you know, we can go back and talk about them. I think it's always okay if you've got a relationship with your child, if you are connected with your child, and if you do feel that that's not a difficult conversation to connect in, love and care and nurture and support are never far from what a child needs. So I think it's perfectly fine to say, you know, I'm just checking in with you. Is everything okay? Talk to me. Is there anything I can do to help? It doesn't even need to be, I see your, I'm worried about you binge eating. It can be where it's more a conversation in their general wellness. And I've said to you before, you know, those three pillars, if you're noticing sleep issues, nutrition, food, even hydration related issues, or you're noticing lack of exercise or over exercising, have those conversations and talk about balance in our homes. Like, feeding ourselves is incredibly important, but feeding ourselves with food is only a part of that. So feeding ourselves with good relationships in our home, good conversations in our home, spiritual conversations, emotional conversations as parents is incredibly important, and food is just a part of that feeding. So I think we should, you know, we don't just want to have these conversations about eating disorder. We want to have these conversations about feeding ourselves in all the aspects of what's good for our kids. And I think food is very definitely just a part of that.
And do you think that because life is so busy now, and I mean, take COVID out of it, because obviously eating disorders have been around for years, but, you know, do you think that maybe we don't sit down enough as a family together to eat? Maybe there's not that kind of place for conversation or fun around food, where everything just seems, everybody's just racing along, just working, you know?
100%. And I don't think that's got anything to do with food. You just mentioned the word there, which we should, you know, have a whole different podcast on, but it's the word fun. And truthfully, we've taken the fun out of cooking. We've put stress into food. We've put stress into eating food. I love to eat, sit and eat with, you know, I've traveled all over the world in different countries, and I love that food and eating and table time is a part of connection and relationship. And very often I hear from families where feeding time is a time of stress and difficulty in homes. And I suppose I'd love to see that removed and have conversations about how we could do that better. Because family time around a table very often now can be in front of a TV or on a screen. And I think that's a terrible shame. But I love the idea of families cooking together. I love the idea of families baking together, having fun. You know, I was having a laugh here the other day. A couple of my kids were reminding me of a time where my son and I were having, I don't know what age he's 24 now, but he's probably about 11 or 12 at the time. But at some point through baking something, amongst all of us as a family, there was an egg cracked on Dad's head, which we thought was hilarious. And very swiftly followed by him telling us one of the foods he hated most was custard. So Dad swiftly jumped into a bowl of custard over his head. So having actually a bit of mad family time.
Yeah.
And doing crazy things that we talk about for years and we normalize and have fun with. That sort of isn't around so much anymore.
And it's so... I'm only thinking as I'm going along here, because, you know, we're I teach Pilates as my main kind of career, I suppose. So we've always been a very healthy, fit and all of that lifestyle. But as the kids have got older, funnily enough, I do watch them all quite a bit. I had an eating disorder when I was a child. Actually, I don't know whether, do you ever recover from an eating disorder? That's the other question for you in a second. But I do know that because our kids have grown up in an environment where, you know, I've always cooked everything and there's lots of exercise, I often wonder, am I creating a bad scenario for them? Because I do watch them and sometimes they do take things to extremes. It's just trying to find, it feels like you just can't win, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess so. And I think that is difficult because, you know, I think we're all guilty of giving in to our kids in relation to what they, in many houses I hear parents cooking two or three different dinners. You know, I grew up in a household where my mother and father, my mother would cook more or less most of the dinners, and her agreement with us when we were very young is, what, you don't have to eat it, you do have to try it, because you want us to try numbers of types of foods, you know? I remember having standoffs when I was a kid, kind of going, you know, there's no way I'm eating that. My pet hate was prunes. I don't know why we got them. They were a dessert item, and my dad loved them with custard. To me, that was just a form of torture. So I remember, I can still remember the day sitting around the table where the option was given to me. If you don't eat that, you can go to your room immediately. And I was like, excellent. So there's an option. There's a way out of this. I'm off to my room. And I think we've created conversations around food that are just different than when I was young. So my conversations now with my kids are, from a very young age, is instead of saying you have to try it, you know, you don't have to eat it. My conversations with my kids when they were very young was, you don't have to like it, you just have to eat it. Mm-hmm. With the result, when they were younger, Jen, they ate everything. They weren't forced about it, but they literally ate pretty much everything, to the extent that today they've probably chosen the things they do and don't like because they're a little bit older. I've kids from 29 down to 10, but they will tend to chomp on a pepper or as much as they'll chomp on a chip. And I suppose we've probably, because of our lifestyle, because of the fastness of life and the pace of life and the options that are out there, we've probably just given in from the point of ease. Whatever you want, you can have, and you can have it in 10 seconds through Uber Eats, you know?
Mm-hmm. But like, look, the chances are, if you're a child and you're developing an eating disorder or going through disordered eating, you know, and your parents bring it up with you, chances are you're not going to want to have a chat with them. So I find that the scary bit, because, you know, I'm hoping my kids are okay and they're eating well and all that, because I'm watching and I'm the one, I suppose, feeding them, particularly if they're young enough to be in the house. But if you're suspicious of something going on, what are the watch outs for parents, and when is it time to intervene?
Yeah, I think the first part of that is, like we said earlier, is normalizing the conversation. So you are noticing things, you're probably seeing things, and we're choosing in some ways as parents not to put any emphasis on that. Or it's a bit like, you know, never mention suicide because you could put it in their mind and they might take it as an option. And we know that's not fact. So we need to be able to have conversations. I often talk, and like we talked before, about red zones and green zones, our red zones being times of mayhem. And we know, don't talk to kids in times of mayhem. When they're stressed out and you're talking about an eating issue, they're not going to take it well. Have a green zone conversation, a couch time chat in the evening, a sit down on a conversation. And, you know, we can approach it in the way of, I'm probably overthinking this as your mother or your father. I love you to pieces, but I just want to check in with you. I've noticed this and this. Just don't say, have you, or are you, or I'm worried. It's kind of like, I've noticed this, and sort of stop there, because what we want our kids to do is to bring to us, you know, if we say things like, are you this? The answer is always no, pretty much, because they don't want to worry you or because they don't want to admit to it. But if we kind of ask them, I've noticed this, and leave time for them to communicate back to us, or just be silent, let them talk. Very often, if they have a concern or a worry, they have an opportunity then to bring it to you. Very often, it's not even said in words, but it will come in tears. But parents, we tend to fill the space, Jen. Really, we want our kids to fill that space and tell us what's going on for them, you know?
Gosh, okay. Yeah, it's certainly a scary one. And I wonder, and we touched on this a little bit when Avine was on, dietitian, you know, are we doing the right thing as parents as well? Because it's a bit like monkey see, monkey do, you know, and parents dieting in the house and, you know, and this is not, look, I'm just, I wonder, are kids picking an awful lot of that up from us? You know, I remember years gone by, and I do it all the time, where you're not feeling, say, body confident. So it might just be out of your mouth before you know it. And the next thing, they listen to everything, really.
Yeah, they pick up on everything that's going on around them. I think we're, you know, we can, our communication around this, I say this for dads and for mums slightly differently. You know, I've four girls and one boy, and my communication to them when they're getting dressed up to go out isn't all about how they look. It's about, you know, it's not just, I'm not affirming them in their beauty, so to speak, if that makes sense, or what they're wearing. It's more about who they are as a person. So we got to be careful that we're not putting the pressure on them, you know, being able to have conversations with them about what you admire about them as a person, as opposed to what they look like when they're going out on a Saturday evening, is really, really important. It doesn't mean that, listen, every dad thinks their daughters are beautiful, their son is a legend, you know, and that's wonderful. We should be that way. But we don't overemphasize that from the point of view of how they look.
Absolutely.
We're living in a very competitive world, Jen. And I think particularly, it's, as I said, it's coming on pressurized for boys, but particularly for girls. Who would want to be growing up as a teenage girl right now?
Yeah, yeah, crikey. Absolutely. Age-wise, are you seeing, so you said earlier, kind of 12, 13, Avian kind of said from her point of view, she has kids as young as 8 or 9 now coming into her clinic.
Yeah, and you, I suppose in some ways you'd start to see disordered probably a little bit around that age. So you can see that from, you know, probably 9, 10 years of age. And that can be very definitely linked into inappropriate use of social media, seeing things too early, too young, Snapchat, Instagram. The Instagram world for this is shocking for young girls. So I would
But you can't get them off it. So, you know, no. I mean, we like that's something. I mean, if you could listen, if you can figure out how to get them off it without there being a massive row and this, you know, so there. And I suppose we have to learn to live with it anyway, because everyone's on it.
We totally do, but not that young, Jen. This is the problem. So yeah. 9 or 10 year olds, forgive me, but if we as parents have our 9 or 10 year olds on Instagram, we are really not helping.
Absolutely. You're right. Sorry, I didn't mean for the 9 year olds.
I'll be honest. And even Snapchat, the pressure of communication and what they look like. And these are talked about, you know, from 8 or 9 year old boys in Snapchat groups with 8 or 9 year old girls. They're put down very quickly, very easily. They're talked to in ways that it's just an 8 or 9 or 10 year old. Listen, a 13 year old, 14 year old can't do that. I mean, girls and boys are different in their behavior online at that age. And girls at that age, forgive me, it sounds sexist to say this, but they tend to go at each other in a very competitive manner at that age group. They'd be, you know, competitive and almost cutthroat in how they communicate to each other, because they're not able to manage social media until, well, I always say to about 15 or so in transition year, but yeah. I know that's probably maybe not idealistic, but certainly 13 and 14 year olds would be better to be able to cope with that than 9 or 10 year olds.
Yeah, yeah. But if you do notice that they're obviously they're all on freaking screens, and that's a whole other conversation, because they've had to be, first of all year, because of learning, etc., and trying to be social online and keep the connection. Like, how do you get the phone off them? I mean, I know that sounds ridiculous, that obviously just take it, but then comes the row, and then I am talking here now 13 years, 14, that age group, not the 9 or 10s. They're probably too young to have a phone anyway.
Well, I suppose we're hoping. A lot of the kind of connection work I would do in primary schools is to try and look, we've made all the mistakes, right? So let's not beat ourselves up as parents. You know, my 24-year-old has grown up on a phone in all the wrong ways, probably that I didn't notice or realize. I'm learning that better with my 17-year-old, 14-year-old, etc. And we're learning. I suppose I'm trying to speak in schools, talk with teachers, talk with parents about letting the primary school grow out of phones. So that they don't need to have, they can have phones, but they don't need to have smartphones. Mm-hmm. I think the percentages were that 40% of fourth class kids have smartphones. That goes up to 65-70% in fifth class. And by the end of fifth class, it goes up to 95% of fifth class kids have smartphones. And, you know, I was asked, speaking in a school just pre-COVID, I was asked about, you know, what age. Was a man, a father in the group, asked me, what age should we give smartphones to our boys, you know? And my first question back to him was, well, what age are you comfortable with your son watching porn?
Wow. Yeah.
And that's what happened. There was silence. And he looked at me and I said, so I'm not saying your son's gone searching for it. I don't know your son, but I'm telling you, every other kid is, this is what they're doing. So do they need a smartphone at that age? And it might be that we decide to let it grow out of primary schools. That's the ideal. And if it starts to go in, you know, smartphones in secondary schools, first years, etc. Because I agree with the connectivity side of having a phone. Mm-hmm. They can ring you after school if there's a problem or an emergency or blah, blah, blah. That's fine. But they don't need a smartphone with all these apps that can cause them great difficulty, that they're not having the skills to be able to maneuver. And just delaying it a little bit. So even if it gets to secondary school, where they're getting these, you know, the Instagrams and such, like when they're hitting the kind of middle years, third year, TY, as opposed to watching, like 13 year olds using Instagram concerns, because what are they seeing on Instagram other than the fear of missing out through Snapchat, what they look like, the fear of looking good, what they need to look like, body image, etc., in Instagram, and who they're following and influencers, and oh my goodness, it gets so competitive.
Absolutely. But is that realistic? Because like my son, he's in first year, he has a smartphone, and I would love him not to have a smartphone. But I know if he didn't have one, everybody else has one, back and forth. He'd grind me down, Stewie. Yeah. He would literally grind me down.
It's not realistic to take them off them, but what's realistic is to take them off them at certain times.
Yeah.
So, you know, what I see more so Jen, I'm struggling with this in my house too. Every one of us is a parent, let's be honest about it. But what we are trying to do more and more is to create appropriate boundaries. We have a sleep deprived generation of young people right now. And a lot of that comes from the inappropriate bedtime routines, of which phones is a significant part of that, or PlayStation or whatever. And we need to pull back from those things. And parents, I hope parents come away from this, listening to this podcast, feeling encouraged, not discouraged, because we've got these issues going on. We can deal with these. We can put in things in place that will help. So during COVID, don't beat yourselves up. When we've had lockdowns, don't beat yourself up. We've pushed our kids from 5 hours a day average to 15 hours a day. That's not your fault. That had to happen. They needed connectivity. They needed education. Let's move on past that. Post-COVID times, let's just reaware that the bedtime routine for an hour and a half before you head towards bed, as best as is possible, should not include a smartphone. And when I say not include a smartphone, I don't mean that you can't listen to a podcast or you can't listen to an audio. What I'm talking about is the visual context of looking at a phone, which is what produces the cortisol and stress. And therefore, that interrupts our production of melatonin, which is a sleep cycle, and brings down our serotonin levels. So what we're seeing, common, ask your GPs in our localities, is sleep-deprived kids and kids in general terms with stress levels too high and serotonin mood too low. And what does that equate to? Massive rises in anxiety, massive rises in body dysmorphia, but all the issues that we've talked about, and massive rises in low mood, reactive depression.
Yeah,
that's not just because we're sitting around, you know, talking about the issues, or our kids are more mentally aware now. That's because we've had an influx of the devices for the last 5 or 6 years. So the good things that we can do, and I often talk about this, you need to go to our website and see this, walk, talk, read and write, get out and do it, get out and communicate it, have chats, all the things that organically increase our serotonin and decrease our cortisol. It's not rocket science. We're doing it thousands of years. And that's,
but what if they won't do it with you?
Even if it's small things, like I had a young girl the other day who really struggled, which she's like, no, every evening she's got a really tight routine. She's in school, coming home from school. She's got kind of different things that she has to do with study. All of it's on, you know, predominantly online when she comes home. She's in the laptop, etc. And then I have my friendship time, my connection time, my friends, and I talk to my friends. And a small thing that made a big difference. So I'm saying, okay, so an hour and a half before you go to bed, can you do without screens? By the way, when I say screens, I'm not talking about TV or Kindles. They don't have the same impact because they don't have a backlight. So that is better. It's not as good as watching, you know, going for a walk or reading a book, because that literally brings down our cortisol and increases our serotonin. But it is better than watching something with a backlight. And one of the things that she agreed she could do, and it literally transformed her sleep and her general wellness within 3 days, she came back to me and said, we changed her last half hour and a half before bed. She would chat to her boyfriend. She would have an audio conversation with him through Bluetooth and go for a walk. So she would literally walk around. And at one point she said she was walking in her back garden because it got dark during, you know, the winter months or whatever. But she would have I used to go underneath the stairs in my house and at 14 years of age and talk on the phone for an hour. You know, my parents would complain and get out to me and say, it's costing a fortune, get out from underneath the stairs because you're talking to some girlfriend somewhere in the country. I have no problem with kids' connectivity and doing that. That's fine. It's part of growing up. Do it while you're walking. Stop FaceTiming. Stop looking on House Party where it's visual all the time. If it's on audio and you're physically walking as well as having an audio conversation, that's not increasing or spiking your cortisol.
And it's also not putting images in your head for when you go to sleep, then trying to go to sleep. And if you've got body dysmorphia, all of that then is going racing around your head. Gosh, it's a really tricky one. So obviously you've dealt with lots of people that have had eating disorders or disordered eating. Is this something that you can fully recover from? Or is it about how soon you get to it?
I think what's important as well as to differentiate is that it's not uncommon to work with disordered eating. And one of the very first things, if I'm concerned as a therapist working with somebody who's moving towards what I perceive as being more than disordered eating, is that I'm not isolated and I'm not alone with that. So I would work as part of a team. So I would always have connection with their GP. We'd always then move into a referral into potentially either psychiatric services or hospital. You're part of a team then, as you said earlier, with dietitians, nutritionists. And that's really important. I think we need to be careful of the message to other therapists out there is that we're not experts in disordered eating or in eating disorders, and you can't get isolated unless you're specifically trained for that in hospital where that's what you do all the time. So it can turn from being a psychological issue into a medical condition that's terribly dangerous. And that's why we have to be very clear and differentiate between the two, Jen.
Yeah. Have you seen a massive rise during COVID?
Yeah, we've seen a rise in everything during COVID. Mm. And don't forget, underneath all of this, even in eating disorders, this can start out with self-esteem and anxiety and all sorts of other things. And eating becomes a control mechanism for that. So yeah, we've seen a rise in all sorts of issues as a result. But we also, you got to remember that there can be great success by bringing this from being an underground conversation into the forefront, and great success. And as you know yourself, people can come through this. Do you ever get rid of it? It's a bit like, I suppose in some ways, you know, if I was to ask somebody who had an eating disorder, you know, what was life like beyond the eating disorder? Because there's a recovery period, of course, when it's significantly difficult and the eating disorder is in the forefront of your mind. And as we work through that, it's kind of like beyond the eating disorder. So it's like life after that. And that might be where nutrition becomes a part of your life. You know, exercise becomes a good and healthy and important part of your life. Is there an eating disorder at the back of your mind? The weird thing is, in some ways, Jen, it can shape us to being an even better version of ourselves because we realize the importance of correct, orderly eating, if that makes sense.
Yeah. If you're lucky enough to get the help. And moving into, you're probably talking about this anyway, but a child that is overweight, I'm assuming it's all the same. It's coming from somewhere emotional, you know, and that as well can be very tricky, because if you have a child that's overweight, and particularly in the last year, eating way too much, sitting in front of the screens and not moving at all, no school sports and all the rest, then you're kind of going, well, I don't want to bring this up or that up because I don't want them to develop an eating disorder. It just feels like you can't win almost either way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and I think we are probably seeing quite a bit of this over COVID, to be honest, because we created a sedate lifestyle. So staying in your room, doing school for 6 hours a day, etc. Obviously talking to your friends online. So we have had less energy being used, less vitality, less getting out there. So, of course, if we continue to eat the same way as we did without all that exercise, we were putting on the COVID pounds, as people have communicated, you know. So I think that's normal enough. And I think in our young people, we really need to be careful that we don't emphasize that being really an issue or a problem. That's not their fault. If they've put on a few extra pounds over COVID, that will naturally, in our young people, when they get mobile again, you know, will come off. I think that's... comfort eating in our young people, again, can be a couple of different things. That can be genetic, it can be behavioral. We can come from a family where overeating is something that happens from a parental perspective. So we do see that happening in genetics, but in behavior as well, Jen. And that behavior over COVID has been the same because it's been difficult for parents.
And I suppose a little bit of that then comes back to, as a parent, you have to try as much as you can to set a really good example in terms of like having the healthy, balanced eating and doing a little bit of exercise. I often wonder, you know, just because today, you know, a kid can walk into a shop with a euro and come out with 5 bars and 3 cans of Coke and 4 bags of crisps, because rubbish is just for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I suppose, you know, when I was growing up, you got your Friday treat and that was kind of the end.
If you were lucky.
And that was pretty much it. I suppose nowadays when I see kids drinking these monster drinks and all these isotonic drinks, and when they don't need them.
And the minute you say, I don't want you drinking that, they're drinking them even more.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, it's a counteraction, isn't it? It's a conversation around the things they should be doing as well as the things they shouldn't be doing. So if we tell them they shouldn't be doing that, they're going to get active in doing that and seeking ways to go behind our back. Conversations with our kids and that about probably normalizing things like nutrition and being a part of that and understanding about that. Did you ever do this? I'm guilty of this. So I keep talking about going out and going for a run and exercising or going to the gym. And I think about that while I'm sitting on the couch eating crisps. So I action always precedes motivation. So motion creates motivation. We wait until we're motivated enough. And usually that's out of desperation because we put the pounds on before we go to the gym. And what I always say to parents is, don't tell your kids they should be exercising more. Go and exercise more. And kids will regularly, you know, want to go for a walk. Do you want to come and do this? Do you want to kick a ball? Do you want to? And it's not up to our kids. It's not up to us to drag our kids to do what we want to do. It's to try and see what is it that they would love to do. And I need to get up and get motivated, get into motion to create the motivation that they will continue to do that. And that's again, mountain bikes, for goodness sake, or something that they don't really want to do on a Saturday afternoon. But they know if they do that, their kids are going to love it. Every young boy, they want excitement and they want adventure.
So we could talk about this all day because it's a topic that you can't just cover in 40 minutes on a podcast, but it is going to lead us into our next podcast, which is dealing with a child that is suffering with anxiety.
So that is where we are going to leave it today, guys. So listen in again next week where we discuss anxiety and peer pressure in children and teens. And remember, if you're liking what you're hearing, please come and subscribe to the podcast and follow me on Instagram at the When Podcast. Thanks a million. Bye.